They had to walk around the sewage flowing in the dirt street. They kept moving, looking neither left nor right, but scanning both directions with peripheral vision. Diller decided he could not walk any more. He got on the radio and called Nelson. "Dude, where are you?" He gave Nelson his position. Nelson, traveling north of Diller, was shocked to hear his friend's voice come over the radio. "We are a mile from you. Stay there," said Nelson. "I'm sending somebody down." Diller was standing by the side of the road when he saw a six-wheeled buggy approaching, one of the gators he'd heard about. He smiled when he saw Spencer at the wheel. They hugged, and Diller and his men slid on board, and Spencer gunned the buggy. After his days spent on horseback, Diller felt strange sitting in a vehicle, watching the road zip past. He had to fight to stay awake. In the early pre-dawn hours of November 9, Sergeant Pat Essex had bedded down for the night near Shulgare, when the cell phone of one of the Northern Alliance guards rang. Dostum was calling. He needed Americans to help clear the enemy from the Tiangi Gap, 5 miles up the road to the north. Essex, along with Milo and Winehouse, grabbed their gear and crammed into a tiny Russian jeep. They were driven through a cold, steady rain to a staging area at the base of the gap. General Dostum was waiting for them with a map spread before him. In their best pointy talk, Essex didn't speak Uzbek, and Dostum didn't speak English. Essex figured out what the general wanted. He asked the Americans to climb up the heights to the top of a mountain ridge, about 4,000 feet above them, overlooking the Tiangi Gap and the Darya Balk River flowing through it. From there, Essex and Milo's job would be to bomb Taliban artillery hiding in wait on the north side of the gap. The Tiangi Gap is about a mile-long cut through the mountain ridge that divides the country's wilds from Mazar and its more civilized metropolis, 20 miles to the north. Over the millennia, the Darya Balk River had carved its bed through the 6,000-foot wall of rock, which runs for several hundred miles east and west. The cut through the mountain wall was a natural choke point. Whoever controlled the heights around the gap controlled passage through it. Essex, Winehouse, and Milo left the warlord and began to make their way up the slick rock face. It was tough going. Their heavy night vision goggles wouldn't stay on during the bruising ride, and Essex clung to the saddle as his horse navigated the steep switchbacks. Finally, the incline got too steep, and the three men got off their horses and walked them to the top. All the while, they could hear bullets zinging by them, Taliban soldiers shooting wildly in the dark. They worried that the Taliban had already taken the ridgetop. They expected a fight at the top. They finally reached the summit at about 3 a.m., and Essex was shocked to find that the Taliban had made no effort to occupy this rocky outlook. This told him that they were in even greater disarray than he had imagined. One of the first rules of war was, always control the high ground. The rain slowed to a drizzle. Ben Milo climbed into a sleeping bag wearing a fleece jacket and long underwear, and lay down in one of the rock trenches dug into the mountaintop. Five Afghans, Northern Alliance soldiers who reached the top earlier, had simply wrapped themselves in tattered blankets and trash bags and curled up on the cold ground. Others were making do with cellophane that had been used to wrap the Special Forces' airdropped supplies. Milo felt pampered in his expensive cold-weather gear. He and Essex were concerned they'd wake up and find the Taliban just several hundred feet down the mountainside, on the slope facing Mazar. They spread landmines around the perimeter and sat listening to the tick of the rain and the wet wind moving through the rocks. Even at first light, around 6 or 7 o'clock, Essex couldn't see anything off the mountain. The mist was too thick. And then around 9, the sun appeared, and burned away the cover. Daylight revealed a landscape that Essex thought resembled Colorado. The cliff face, some 2,000 to 3,000 feet high, dropped straight to the river below, which formed the Tiangi Gap. No grass, a few trees sprinkled like matchsticks in the distance. A bomb-cratered road hugged the green, chalky current of the Darya Bok, and followed it north. In places, the rock walls closed in, and the passageway was only as wide as a three-lane road. Essex looked down and saw a series of four enemy trenches dug in on the tops of gentle hills. He started calling in the bombs immediately, but it was tough. He would identify a target, a Toyota pickup truck, for example, and the pilot would radio back, "We can't strike that." "Look, buddy," said Essex, "that's a personnel carrier." "Personnel carrier? Well, it looks like a truck." Nelson, listening in, got on the line and told the hesitant pilot, "Any military vehicle on the battlefield, be at liberty to destroy." "Wait a minute, come on now," said the pilot. Nelson explained, "All friendlies are either on foot or they're riding horses." The pilot asked Nelson to repeat the part about the horses. "We're riding horses," Nelson explained. The pilot, obviously new to the conflict, couldn't believe it. "You guys are doing what?" Essex, Milo, and Winehouse called bombs on anything they could spot. Truck-mounted guns, vehicles, and Taliban troops. Milo identified at least 12 targets. They had blown up about half of them, when they suddenly came under counterattack. Essex could hear a faint whoom, 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 and he recognized the sound from his stint in the Gulf War. Milo and Winehouse looked at him. "What's the matter?" And then the rockets hit. Down in the valley, Dostum and Lieutenant Colonel Bowers, along with several hundred of Dostum's men, had begun moving into the pass. Dostum had staggered the departure of his men to keep some fighters in reserve in case the Taliban attacked. After the rocket attack, Essex, up in his mountaintop perch, feared that Dostum, Bowers, and all the soldiers were dead. Nelson, meanwhile, was standing at the south end of the gap, about a half mile from its entrance, when the Taliban rocket barrage started. The rockets ricocheted off the canyon sides, spinning end over end and exploding. Molten skeins of shrapnel clawed at the rock walls. Nelson counted 21 rockets in all. He didn't think anyone could survive the barrage. After the first explosions, Dostum's men had scrambled up the rock and tucked themselves on ledges and hid behind outcroppings. They were unsure of what to do next. Some of them were out of their minds with fear. The rolling explosions had been terrifying. Nelson knew that these kinds of rockets, called BM-21s, landed in salvos. They were launched from a wheeled pad capable of holding 40 of the 9-foot-long projectiles. Nelson guessed the Taliban wasn't done with them yet. He worried about Dostum and Bowers. The canyon exploded again, driving even more men up into hiding in the nooks and crannies. Around them, horses lay kicking in the dirt, riddled with shrapnel. Men walked around holding their eyes, blinded. Arms and legs that had been blown high in the air landed with sickening thuds along the riverbank. Nelson, sitting on his horse, watched smoke drift out the canyon's mouth. He turned in his saddle and surveyed the remaining Afghans with him. They were scared. So was he. He turned back and faced the canyon mouth and tried to think what to do. He'd wait. He figured they were in for more salvos. After several minutes, none came. He knew that Diller was somewhere off to his right, in the east. He didn't know if he was dead or alive. Essex was also on his right, up on the ridge. Nelson tried raising Bowers and Dostum on the radio. Nothing. He then called Essex, up on the ridge. "I don't have comms with Dostum. Can you see him?" Essex said he couldn't see into the canyon. A ridge was blocking his view. Nelson worried that everyone was dead. About 1 mile west of Nelson in the gap, Diller was skirting along the crumbling foothills and looking for a trail up and over the mountain when the rockets started landing around him. His job, after leaving Shulgare, was to keep moving east and hit the edge of Mazar not by the main road as Nelson was doing, but through the backcountry. The rest of his team, as well as Atta and Dean's men, were to travel through the gap and enter Mazar by the main highway that led into the city. Along the way, Diller was to hunt for Taliban soldiers in hiding, who might circle and attack the approaching main force from its rear. He heard the rockets launch, just as he was getting on his horse. He froze, with his left leg in the stirrup, and his right swung over the horse's rump. The rocket made a screeching, "choo" sound, and exploded about 100 yards away down a ridge. Diller's horse reared, and he was thrown backward, and lay a moment looking up at the sky. He scrambled up and started running after the horse. Most of all, he was afraid he'd lose it, and that one of the Afghans would claim it for himself. Sure enough, as Diller ran a short distance through the smoke, he saw an Afghan soldier, one of Dostum's men, reaching for the reins. Diller ran up and snatched them from the man and yelled, "No!" He then tried leading the frightened animal down the hill, but it wouldn't budge. Diller reared back and punched the horse in the jaw. He dragged its head down to the ground just as the second rocket barrage came in. The explosion threw him on his back in a ditch. The horse was standing over him, its feet straddling the edges of the deep depression in the ground. He looked up at the horse, silhouetted against the sky. The horse was looking down at him as the rockets crashed. Diller thought Bennett and Coffers were probably dead. They'd ridden ahead a few minutes before the rocket attack, and he didn't know where they were. He lay there listening for the telltale screech of a next launch. It was quiet. The barrage had come from the north and west, from the backside of the gap, about a mile away. He figured the Taliban hadn't targeted him specifically. They were spraying the ground indiscriminately. He turned at the sound of approaching hoofbeats. Bennett and Coffers were riding up fast. They pulled to a halt, and Diller stood up and brushed himself off. They explained that when the barrage started, their horses had taken off, and they couldn't stop them running. They had laid out along the necks of the racing animals and held on. The horses ran maybe a half mile, then stopped. Then they'd turned them and raced back to Diller. Commander Ali Sarwar, who had watched Nelson and his team get off the helicopter 3 weeks earlier at Dehi, was attacked by BM-21 rockets in the gap as he moved the 25 soldiers under his command. He had been traveling and riding with Commander Kamal, attached to Essex Group. Ali had been fearless throughout the campaign, but the rockets falling around him were terrifying, totally random. The canyon rang with their explosions. He heard the whooshing sound of their launching, one after another. They started hitting his horsemen. When the smoke cleared, 5 rockets had hit in the canyon. Others had flown over and crashed on hillsides, near Sam Diller and Bill Bennett, traveling north on the east rim of the canyon. Ali could see about 65 men lying dead in the canyon floor. Their horses were in pieces around them. The blasts had split one horse in half, lengthwise, so the animal was laid out on a pile of its own guts, and its feet were spread in all four directions, as if staked to the ground. After leaving Shulgare, Ali and his men had moved up the road through the gap and found it littered with cars that had been bombed by American airstrikes. Some of the cars were charred and melted on the road. Others were perfectly fine. The Taliban drivers, terrified, had abandoned them with the keys still in the ignition and ran north into the hills to escape the Americans' bombs that seemed to haunt the road. As Ali rode through the canyon after the rocket attack, he spied something ahead on the road that scared him. His first thought was to flee. He squinted and saw about 50 cars and pickups racing toward him. The vehicles were still a half mile away, but they were coming, that was for sure. And they were filled with Taliban soldiers. Ali and his men had fought for 3 weeks without rest. But here they were going to have another fight, a bad one. Ali looked behind him. He and his men could head back down the river valley. If we push ahead, he thought, we could be killed. He inched down in the saddle, jammed the magazine tight in the rifle, making sure it was there. It's either victory or death, thought Ali. If God is with me, I will go toward Mazar. Ali and his men rode into a furious firefight. They battled for 2 hours, and Ali lost several men. But they killed many Taliban. He watched as the survivors of his wrath scrambled back the way they had come in their pickups, heading north up the valley to Mazar. Nelson, sitting on his horse at the mouth of the gap, saw that the Taliban rocket attack had quashed the forward momentum of the Northern Alliance. Nelson felt this was a critical moment. Dostum's men had scattered into the hills. He knew he had to do something. He could see men lying up in the rocks like stunned lizards. You have to lead these men, he thought. If they stopped here, the Taliban might have time to regroup and attack again. He swallowed hard and spurred his horse ahead. Inside the canyon, Taliban vehicles were canted and burning. The drivers had been burned alive and spilled from the doors, dark as wicks. Nelson looked down to the river and saw more men and horses lying in the water. The Taliban had even mined the river. At the sound of his approach, Nelson saw men stand up on the rock ledges and look at him. They looked startled and watched him pass. And then slowly, one by one, he heard them scrabbling off the rock, the scrape and trickle of pebbles rolling downhill. He closed his eyes and thanked God. He was horrified by the sights around him, yet he felt exuberant. It was hard to explain. He had hoped the Afghans would follow him. If they hadn't, he would have felt that he'd failed as a U.S. Army captain. As a teenager in Kansas, he had always admired a particular painting of a Civil War battle. It depicted a general riding through a battlefield, and following him were his men, hollow-eyed, trusting, hopeful. He felt that whatever happened in his military career, for this moment, he was leading these men through a version of hell. He still had no idea if they'd be attacked again by more rockets. He kept riding. He looked behind him and saw that about 300 Afghans were marching with him, some carrying weapons, others walking empty-handed, their rifles having been lost in the explosions. About halfway through the canyon, he found Lieutenant Colonel Bowers and General Dostum. After walking about a quarter mile, Bowers had been caught in the barrage of rockets, which exploded about 25 yards from where he'd been sitting on his horse. All of the animals started to rear, threatening a stampede. Bowers ordered his men to dismount and hide in a nearby hillside. and they crammed into what looked like a crack in the rock, while Bowers stood before them, trying to shield them. One man tried containing all the horses by grabbing their leads, but most of the animals broke free and started running up and down the canyon. Nelson hugged Dostum, who asked him where he'd been. The burly warlord had worried that Nelson had been killed in the attacks.
"I got here as soon as I could," said Nelson.
They rode back through the gap and met Essex, Milo, and Winehouse as they walked down from their observation post atop the mountain. When Major Mark Mitchell arrived in a truck, along with his team, the entire force was ready to move into Mazar. The gap was cleared. Dean and Atta stopped at sunset at the south end of the gap for prayer. Atta planned to spend the night here, before heading to Mazar at dawn with Dostum. Dostum's men were picketed a half mile farther south, along the same road. Most of them were on horseback, while Atta's men were traveling by vehicle. Atta had either bought, stolen, or captured all the vehicles he could from the Taliban. Dostum, on the other hand, was overextended. His men and horses needed time to rest. They couldn't keep up with the speed of Atta's mechanized advance. The two warlords met and agreed that no one would leave for Mazar-i-Sharif until dawn. Victory would be theirs, as comrades in arms. Dostum didn't know that Atta had other plans. Atta already had forces inside Mazar-i-Sharif, holding select pockets, even though the city still crawled with Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters. He was eager to beat Dostum into the prized city. After the meeting, Dean watched as Atta sat on a carpet in the dirt, surrounded by different satellite phones, all jerry-rigged to run off car batteries, and began talking to different Taliban commanders in Mazar-i-Sharif. He was trying to arrange defections and increase his own troop strength with the newly surrendered soldiers. Dean admired his smooth and efficient diplomacy. Meanwhile, in Mazar, hundreds of Taliban vehicles, their headlights bobbing in the dark and visible for miles, were fleeing the city for Kunduz, 8 hours to the east over a bumpy road. The trucks were filled with retreating enemy fighters. Atta decided he couldn't wait any longer. He had to get to Mazar before any more Taliban fled for Kunduz. His prospective power base was slipping away from the city. When he heard the news that they were leaving early, Dean readily assented. He had immense respect for the bookish, pious warlord. Dean knew it was not his place to get between Atta and his rivalry with Dostum. He climbed into a jeep and took a seat next to the general. Crammed next to Dean was his senior medic, James Gold, while other members of his team were following behind on horses and in pickups. Dean's second-in-command, Warrant Officer Stu Mansfield, was jammed in the dusty cab of a large wooden-sided truck bringing up the rear of a caravan that measured a half mile long. Atta's several thousand men, on foot, on horseback, and behind the wheels of trucks, wheezing ahead on the few last precious gallons of gas available to his army, lurched ahead through the dark. His men hadn't eaten in several days. This was an army on its last legs. Dean was amused, thinking that he would beat Mitch Nelson into the city. During the last week, the two young army captains had grown competitive, each of them hewing closer to the psychological needs of their warlord. Dean looked over and saw that Atta was smiling. The war, it seemed to Dean, was ending. They'd roll into Mazar, clear the streets of any Taliban refusing to surrender, and begin rebuilding the place. Water and power plants, schools, a police department, the mechanics of daily life, badly needing repair. They'd scour the city for intel about the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden and other al-Qaeda soldiers. A recent report had placed bin Laden in the town of Balkh, 30 miles west of Mazar. The veracity of the report was doubtful. The teams were getting regular notice of these sightings, and most were wishful thinking by Afghan citizens hoping to collect the enormous reward for the terrorist capture. But still, the news excited the team. As they proceeded through the canyon, they drove with their headlights off. Dean didn't know if any Taliban had remained behind to snipe at them from the heights of the mountain wall, but they weren't taking chances. Through his night vision goggles, communications officer Brian Lyle, sitting in the large truck, could see that the gap was about a half mile wide and that the road was narrow and gouged by explosions. It was also littered with blown-up Taliban pickups that loomed suddenly out of the night. The driver kept wrenching the steering wheel to veer around these charred obstacles. The road was cut high into the canyon side, and down several hundred feet below lay the Darya Balkh River. Lyle figured that it'd be easy to sail straight off the edge. He tried crouching lower behind the truck's wooden sides, but this was impossible. Lyle's back was still sticking above the flimsy wood. He thought that it would be hell to get shot in the dark, not even knowing where the deadly round had come from. The team's rucksacks were piled so high that all of the men had to lie on the equipment, and none of them could find good cover. Lyle lay with his rifle poking through the slats. He hoped to hell the Taliban hadn't hung around. About halfway through the canyon, they began to pass the bodies of the Taliban and Afghan soldiers, killed in the fighting earlier in the day. Lyle saw severed arms and legs jutting from the ground as if they had been planted there. It was as if they were driving through the unearthly garden of a macabre giant. Lyle thought it was amazing the way the explosions had severed some of the heads cleanly from the bodies, which often were nowhere to be found. One head watched the men as they approached. Like a painting whose eyes follow you across a room, it tracked them as they passed. Some of the men laughed nervously and snapped pictures with digital cameras. Others turned away in disgust at the sight. After 30 minutes, they drove out of the cooler canyon into the dry air of the plain. The first light of dawn was seeping above the crumpled edge of the horizon, and ahead lay the dark hump of Mazar-i-Sharif. Through his goggles, Lyle could see hundreds more trucks with their headlights on racing from the city, headed to Kunduz. Lyle had received reports that the Taliban were preparing a final battle there, which was now barricaded by thousands of Northern Alliance soldiers. All the roads in and out were cut off. It was a place under siege. Hardcore al-Qaeda soldiers from Saudi Arabia and Pakistan had taken to executing the local Taliban in their midst. These men had only wanted to surrender, walk back to their villages, and return to their lives with their families. Seeing now that Mazar-i-Sharif was so close, the men atop their horses sat up and spurred their reluctant animals and began galloping across the plain. The men in trucks raced their engines and shot off in pursuit. Those on foot began running, swinging up to one of the passing trucks if they could. They were in full flight toward the gates of the city. Near the outskirts, still several miles from the city center, the first crowds of welcoming Afghans appeared. Hundreds of men, women, and children stood and watched as Atta and Dean passed. They clapped and cheered. They stepped to the trucks with outstretched hands to touch the Americans as they passed. They asked the soldiers to take their pictures. Scott Black had two disposable cameras with him, and he did the best he could. The truck was moving briskly as he snapped away. He couldn't figure out why the kids wanted him to take their pictures, since he would never see them again. And then he thought that maybe they just wanted someone to remember them. From his carpet shop, Nadir Sinhab spotted the American soldiers as they entered the city. They came trotting by on horses and zipping past in trucks. They wore scraggly beards and long hair, longer than most American soldiers, and he thought they looked half dead. He noticed, however, that they were gripping their rifles over the tops of their saddles, and that they only looked asleep. They wore sunglasses, and he saw that they constantly scanned the crowd for any sign of trouble. Some of them had wrapped their faces against the dust with long scarves, and there were wet, dark holes where their mouths were. Nadir was on the verge of tears. He thought, "From now on, Afghanistan will be free. I will be free." Part 4. Gates of Mazar. Mazar-i-Sharif, Afghanistan. November 10, 2001. Thousands of people, many clutching paper flowers and candy as gifts for the Americans, were soon rushing past Nadir Sinhab's carpet shop, raising clouds of dust as they ran, shouting, "The Amriki are here! They have taken the city!" Sinhab watched as one man ran past. Unlike the others, there was a frantic look in his eyes. This man, he guessed, was a Taliban policeman, or had been until about 5 minutes ago, when he'd probably ducked behind a building, removed his black turban, torn off his black smock, and started running, hoping to blend in with the rest of the inhabitants of Mazar-i-Sharif. And now the people whom he had tormented as a Taliban policeman wanted to kill him. Soon enough, several men rounded a corner, carrying knives, shovels, and clubs. They pressed him against the wall of a fruit shop, and beat him, swiftly. 1, 2, 3 blows. He slid down the wall, leaving a vertical red stripe as he dropped, then slumped to the ground, dead. "It is over," thought Nadir. "It is finally over." News of victory in Mazar raced through the cities of Afghanistan, borne by walkie-talkies and radio news reports. Only 2 days before, on November 8, Osama bin Laden had been granted Afghan nationality by the struggling Taliban government, led by Mullah Omar. "Now he is not just our guest," announced the Taliban spokesman. "He is a citizen of Afghanistan, and we will not hand him over to the U.S. When people heard this news, they wondered when their country would be free of monsters. Young men and women in places as far away as Kabul, 200 miles to the southeast, now knelt close to their small TV screens wired to bootleg satellite dishes, and watched as Dostum, Nelson, and Dean entered Mazar amid the cheering crowds. This was thrilling. They had feared the powerful weapons of the United States, but they had also prayed the Americans would bomb their country back to a new beginning, so it could be rebuilt from the ashes. After more than 20 years of war, this had seemed the only way to start over. A return to zero. Up the road from Nadir Sinhab's carpet shop, still on the outskirts of the city, Atta's pickup truck had broken down. His men pushed it to the roadside. Dean was worried about Atta's safety amid the crowd. Atta assured Dean that his bodyguards could fix the truck, and he would soon be driving again. He urged Dean to continue on without him. He would follow shortly. Atta, meanwhile, was worried about something else. The sudden rumor of several hundred Taliban holdouts barricaded in a school located in a neighborhood of cinder block apartments. The buildings, 2 to 4 stories high, were within sight of the Blue Mosque, a little over a half mile away. These Taliban, he told Dean, were hard men. Soldiers from Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Chechnya. They were refusing to surrender. Atta said they would fight to their deaths. He warned Dean to be careful. Trust no one. And make sure none of the fighting harmed the Blue Mosque, the city's most sacred religious site. The Taliban had shut it down when they took control, believing its ornate domes and gilded walls were too flashy and inappropriate as a place of worship. Its beauty was an ugliness to them. Dean reluctantly drove on with his team. They had to get into town. Fast. About 500 of Atta's men had already entered the city. The streets were empty and strewn with trash, the curbs stacked with dead bodies. The air rang with the cellophane buzz of flies. Most of the Taliban soldiers who'd occupied Mazar had abandoned it just several hours earlier. In some houses, cooling tea still sat in cups, untouched. Articles of clothing, scarves, smocks, sandals, lay scattered. The Taliban had left in a panic. The city, the men knew, was akin to a giant chessboard, where the opponent was simultaneously losing, resisting, or even advancing, depending upon which square or neighborhood he inhabited. You had to be careful. There were still pockets of frightened fighters hiding in houses, on rooftops, in barricaded storefronts throughout the city. These were men who had been left behind when the majority of the force fled. Upon entering Mazar, half of Atta's men raced in their Toyota pickups to the airport on the western edge and claimed it for their leader. A message was sent out over the radio. Atta has captured the airport. This made Atta an immediate player in the city. Anyone wanting access to the airport was now going to have to deal with him. Dostum was traveling through the Tiangi Gap when he heard the news. He was not happy. He was still several hours from entering the city, leading a tired string of some 1,500 men, on horses and on foot. He decided not to dwell on the loss. He would redouble his efforts to get to the enormous fort known as Kala Ijangi. From there, he would rebuild his own power base. At the height of his control in the early 1990s, he had printed his own money, operated his own commercial airline, and even programmed his own TV station. He had funded schools and insisted that women attend. Children had flocked to movie theaters on weekends to watch the latest love story pumped out by India's Bollywood movie studios. The city had one of the few sanitary water systems in the country, and residents found themselves supplied with electricity 24 hours a day. Dostum had supported a burgeoning middle class, liberal by Afghan standards, and the city of 300,000 souls had been a thriving, if backwater, metropolis. Those were the good old days. Dostum was convinced they would return. While Dostum schemed and fretted in the gap, Atta's men continued to probe the heart of the city, street by street. Firefights broke out, carried out around corners, small arms fire raking the sides of buildings. The families who lived inside hid in closets, under beds, praying the Taliban were finally gone. The gunfights were furious and deadly. Atta lost 30 men over several hours of shooting, but they had the Taliban and Al-Qaeda soldiers on the run. The enemy had retreated to a girls' school, a plain-looking four-story structure built of gray steel with tall walls of classroom windows. Students hadn't filled its hallways for at least 3 years. The Taliban didn't believe in educating girls. They had taken knives and scratched out the eyes on all the photographs and pictures hanging in the building. They believed the Quran prohibited the display of such images. In the late morning, Atta's men snuck across the sparse grass bordering the front. They looked up and down the building, about 100 feet in either direction. They were standing in the middle. They planned to go inside and confront the men, who were suicidally refusing to surrender. Suddenly, a group of Taliban soldiers rushed out of the doors. Both sides opened fire. When they reached Atta's men, the Taliban soldiers pulled the pins from grenades and blew themselves up, taking some of their enemy with them. More Taliban poured out the door, and Atta's men opened fire again, trying to drop them before they drew close. Atta's men quickly retreated a safe distance to nearby houses and carried on the firefight from there. The Taliban shattered the windows within the school and started firing down at the street. The neighborhood popped and rattled with gunfire. As the shooting raged around the school, Dean's convoy entered the town and made its way through the cheering crowd. The team was shocked by the hundreds of men, women, and children clapping along the road, the women peeking shyly over the men's shoulders through the eye slits in their blue burqas. Children ran along the street kicking soccer balls. Others stood in nearby fields, flying kites. "What are the people saying?" Dean asked Wasik, one of the translators Atta had provided the team. "They're shouting blessings," said Wasik. "They like you." The carpet shops, the tire repair stations, the innumerable food stalls selling lamb kebabs, these and every other establishment had been shuttered in anticipation of a final battle with the Taliban. Now shop owners were reopening them, sweeping the doorways. Barbers moved their wooden chairs out into the street, and men lined up impatiently to have their Taliban-required beard shaved off. Dean watched as the smiling men stepped fresh from the chair, rubbing their smooth chins in wonder. He could hear Indian pop music being played on a boombox carried along the street. He would later learn that a commercial radio station had begun playing music as early as 3 a.m. that morning. The day before, the purveyors of this entertainment would have been imprisoned. Dean stopped the convoy, and the team stepped out to shake hands with the people. One of the children ran up and hugged James Gold, who swung the child up in his arms and held him to the sky. Gold was filled with a longing for his own children back in Tennessee as he put the child down, tears in his eyes. Gunfire suddenly broke out, and the team scrambled back into the vehicles. Dean scanned the crowd, looking for the shooter. He saw a man with his AK raised in the air. He had been firing off harmless rounds in celebration. Dean breathed a sigh of relief. From his second-story office on Mazar's main street, Najib Qureshi, 21 years old, saw that the rumors of the Taliban retreat were true. The streets were empty of the usual grim, sanctimonious policemen twirling their leather batons, members of the city's Truth and Prevention of Vice Squad. Certainly the policemen had been less bold these past several days, as the fighting intensified in the mountains south of the city. Good riddance, thought Najib. Najib had always found sport in making fun of the overly serious Taliban. When he was a few years younger, he'd had the legs to outrun them when they chastised him for cutting his hair in the wildly popular Titanic hairstyle, named after the haircut worn by Leonardo DiCaprio in the eponymous movie. "Why do you have the Titanic hair?" the Taliban policeman had pestered Najib. "Because I like it, damn you." And then he'd run away, taunting them over his shoulder. Najib had learned English by listening to the BBC and conversing with any foreign NGO worker who happened to come through Mazar during its war-torn years. This meant that he spoke with a slight British accent, in a reedy voice, verging on sarcasm. He'd grown up in Mazar during the long Soviet occupation and the civil war that followed, and he'd witnessed nearly every manner of savage misanthropy. Yet he maintained in his jaunty step an irresistible joie de vivre He had never been happier in his life than now, when the Taliban were leaving. Earlier that day, his father, the mayor, had told him that their home had been chosen as a safe house for some American soldiers. The chance of a lifetime. Najib dreamed of being a TV news correspondent. He dreamed of visiting America. What better way to practice his English than by making friends with American soldiers? He jumped on his motor scooter, and borne along the stream of celebrating neighbors, hurried home. Amid the continuing celebrations, General Dostum and Captain Mitch Nelson rode into Mazar several hours after Atta. Following close behind were Major Mark Mitchell and his team, led by Lieutenant Colonel Bowers. Mitchell and the team had turned their horses over to Dostum's men at the south end of the gap. Bert Dox, Mitchell's combat controller, could barely walk from his horse to the 2-ton truck that was to carry them through the gap. He winced as it jounced over the road through the canyon. Doc's teammate, fellow combat controller Malcolm Victors, looked around at the dozen Afghan soldiers riding with them, and because they couldn't speak English, he thought they were dumber than him. He knew they weren't. He knew this was an ignorant thing for him to be thinking, but he couldn't help judging them. One of the Afghans, standing at the front of the truck bed and facing ahead, yelled something Victors couldn't understand. A translator told him the guy wanted everyone to keep their arms and legs inside the truck. Yeah, right, thought Victors. What's this guy talking about? A few minutes later, Victors looked up as the truck passed between two rock walls with only inches to spare on either side. Holy smoke, I've got to pay attention. Cal Spencer, wearing his son's student baseball cap, the bill now frayed, embroidered with a maroon FC for Fort Campbell, was overwhelmed by the crowd's reception. He couldn't believe they had captured Mazar so quickly. He was driving one of the gators, loaded with the team's rucksacks. General Dostum approached, having stopped his truck up ahead, and walked back to Spencer. "Take me for a ride," he said. Spencer understood that Dostum wanted to be seen riding alongside the Americans as they entered the city. "Hop in, General." Dostum waved to the crowd as they sped along. He suggested that they hoist an American flag on a pole attached to the buggy. Spencer and Nelson thought it was a good idea. Max Bowers disagreed. "This is their victory," he said. He explained that the Afghans shouldn't perceive the Americans as victors. Both Spencer and Nelson realized that Bowers was right. Dostum, after a short ride, returned to his vehicle. His security detail worried that the crowd had grown too large, nearly 5,000 people. It would be too easy for a Taliban soldier still lurking in town to take a shot. Up ahead loomed a strange building, a towering fortress made entirely of mud. It resembled something out of Arabian Nights. "What's that?" Spencer asked, pointing down the road. "Our new home," shouted Nelson. The convoy of victors rumbled through a tall gate and entered the fort. Spencer asked if the place had a name. Someone in the group, an Afghan, answered, "Kala-i-Jangi." He explained that in English it meant House of War. Leaving his carpet shop, Nadir Sinhab started running like everyone else to welcome the Americans as they passed through the gates of the city. Nadir remembered the first time the Taliban appeared at his house in 1998, looking for his father. The elder had been an officer in the Northern Alliance Army, and the Taliban suspected that he was still a loyal soldier after his retirement, which he had not been. Nadir had heard a Toyota pickup pull up in the dusty street, and several Taliban policemen got out and walked to his house. Nadir waited for the knock, then swung the door open. Is your father in the house? Asked one policeman. His father had warned him to bite his tongue and not criticize these men. They had killed neighbors who lived nearby, and then had the audacity to move into their house. Every day with them was like waking in a land of ghouls, only you were never sleeping. What do you want with my father? We need him to talk. Nadir called his father on his cell phone. They are here. They want you to come home. We're supposed to search your house, the policeman told Nadir's father when he arrived. What are you looking for? Guns? Ammunition? We don't have anything. The Taliban soldier raised an axe and started smashing their closets. He threw their clothes in a pile in the street and set them on fire. Then he barged out of the house and returned shortly carrying a shovel. He announced that he would find weapons buried in the dirt floor, weapons that Nadir's father was hiding as a favor for the infidel General Dostum. He drove the shovel into the dirt and started digging. He found nothing in the kitchen, nothing in the bedrooms. He walked from room to room, leaving piles of dirt everywhere he went. Finally, he left. Nadir and his father stood in the house and surveyed the damage. Then they retrieved shovels of their own and started filling in the holes. Life was like that, thought Nadir. Somebody keeps digging holes in your life, and you keep filling them in. A week later, the Taliban policeman returned. He told Nadir's father, "You said you don't have anything, but someone has told me that you do." He started digging again. "Oh, brother," Nadir's father cried, "we do not have anything buried in our house." After the man had dug several holes, he walked up to Nadir's father and slapped him across the face. "We know you have ammunition. We will take your car and your money." Nadir's father was silent with rage as the Taliban police officer lectured him on being a proper Muslim. "Do you want to scandalize Islam? Do you want to discredit your family?" The officer said to Nadir, "Brother, tell your sister not to go to school. Otherwise, we will kill her." The man was serious. Recently, there had been a chilling message broadcast on the radio in Mazar. "There are only two places for an Afghan woman," the radio announcer had said. "In the husband's home and in the graveyard." Nadir had studied English at Najib's language school in Mazar-i-Sharif, and he was proud of his education, and he was proud of his sisters. "We must study," he told the policeman, "because this country needs the educated person. Tell your sister, if she goes to school, we will kill her." Nadir just shook his head. One day he was walking down the street when he felt that he was being watched. He spotted a Taliban soldier who was pointing an AK-47 at him, holding it at waist level. "Boy, come here," the man barked. "What is the matter, sir?" "Don't talk. What did you do with your beard? Why have you shaved?" Nadir considered his answer carefully, but he could not help himself. "My beard?" he yelled. He pointed at his clean-shaven chin. "This is my beard. It is not your beard." The Taliban wrapped Nadir's wrists with a scarf and hauled him off to a jail in Mazar, where the guard beat him with a rubber hose. Nadir yelled at them, "Islam doesn't depend on only the beard, you know. Islam says, don't kill the person, don't kill the human. A human is a creature of God." He was in jail for 3 days. The Taliban called his father and told him, "We have your son." Then they arrested Nadir's father and carted him down to the jail. His father tried reasoning with the Taliban. "What is wrong with my son? He doesn't have a beard. He's young. Besides, it is his choice whether he grows a beard. The Taliban raised a rubber hose and struck the old man on the shoulder. He held up his arms to ward off the blows. "My son has done nothing wrong," he yelled. "Be silent." They kept hitting him. "He is in violation of God's law." "He will grow a beard. Will that make you happy?" The Taliban threw his father into the same jail cell. They beat him in front of Nadir. It was all the young man could do not to cry out. He was amazed and proud of his father's courage. When the Taliban were done beating him, his father agreed to buy their way out of jail. He gave the Taliban some money, and father and son hobbled out, blinking in the sunlight, walking home arm in arm. Dostum and his security convoy didn't stop at the fort, but continued into Mazar-i-Sharif, to the Blue Mosque. Dostum had triumphantly arrived to reopen it. The rooms had been shuttered during the Taliban's occupation of the city. He stepped from his jeep and looked up at the sparkling minarets. They seemed to float overhead in the midday sun. His muddy boots rang across the tiled courtyard, so peerless that it appeared he was walking across the sky itself. Dostum entered the mosque. He removed his boots and knelt to pray. Beneath the mosque's stone floor, in a sealed crypt, lay the body of Muhammad's son-in-law and cousin, Ali ibn Abi Talib, the fourth caliph of Islam. After his death, in what is now present-day Iraq, the holy man's followers buried him in Baghdad. But later, fearing desecration of the grave, they dug up and bundled his remains onto a white camel, who was set to wandering for days across miles of desert, before collapsing here, on this spot, in Mazar-i-Sharif. Dostum had never been a religious man, but now he prayed. He prayed for Captain Nelson, whom he cared for as if he were a son. "I have been at war my entire life, and I have killed many men. And yet, I am alive." He climbed back into his jeep and motioned for the driver to take him to his headquarters. By day's end, all of the teams had arrived in Mazar-i-Sharif except Diller's. He finally appeared outside Kale-i-Jangi in late afternoon, starved and filthy. In the last 12 hours, he and his team, along with their contingent of Afghans, had marched 30 miles to reach the city. He had been powering up his radio just long enough to raise Nelson and communicate his position before shutting it off. He was low on battery power and conserving every volt. The day before, they'd marched 20 miles. Now, standing in the road 200 yards from the immense fort before him, his legs were numb. He couldn't feel them. He was bleeding down his pant legs, the result of painful saddle sores. After his horse had collapsed from exhaustion on the stony trail, Diller had led it the last 10 miles. Diller looked at the fort ahead, and then he looked at the horse. "Now I know you don't want to," he told the tired, patient animal, "but goddammit, I rode a horse out of Dehi when I started this fight, and I'd like to ride one in." Diller put his foot in the stirrup and sat gingerly in the saddle. He gave the horse a kick. Every bounce was excruciating. Diller grinned like an idiot to avoid crying out in pain. Soon he drew up to the four men standing at the fort's entrance, pulled on the reins, and stopped. Standing there were Nelson, Spencer, Essex, and Milo. Diller sat and just stared at them. It sunk in. He was here, in Mazar. He slid from the saddle with a groan. His teammates rushed forward, shaking Diller's hand and hugging him, It had only been 2 weeks since the entire 12-man group had left K2,